there, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial here with Lisa Arnone and Gianna Valerio, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Today, I want to talk about one of the tools that people use in relationships and a phenomena that we're paying attention to. We're paying attention to a thing called hindsight bias. Very interesting concept. But we've got to get there in a moment. First, let me talk to you. Have you, whenever you're in an argument, I had two men in a men's group yesterday, and they were confronting each other, and they were doing terrific. I mean, they were just talking to each other. One guy was saying one thing, the other guy was listening for information, he talked back, the other person was listening back, and you could see two guys getting heated, but listening. And I thought it was remarkable. The only trouble is it got more and more heated. And as it became more and more heated, I noticed 20 minutes had gone by and they hadn't gotten any resolution. Now, I've got a rule of thumb. If I'm going to be in an argument or a discussion with anybody, it's got to get better. The only reason I'm going to be talking to you in a heated way is because I want to improve what we have, and it may need the heat to get a boil going, you know, so we can make a better soup. Good metaphor. Together. But sometimes, if there's no heat, sometimes the argument is not meant to produce a better outcome. And therefore, if you knew in advance, here comes an argument, the outcome of which will be more negative than if I enter into it, wouldn't you just stop? Wouldn't you just pull up the brakes? Wouldn't someone of the two say, I don't want to be in this discussion? You know a story about a man who told me he woke up the other morning after spending a very romantic time with a woman who he's been trying to work things out with. And they had a very romantic time. But the following morning, an unusual thing happened. Every time he said something, she said something that was contrary to what he said. Now, it doesn't mean she was criticizing him. But if he said, you know, I think there's a problem with Medicaid. She'd say, there is no problem with Medicaid, and she'd go on to talk about that. And he'd say, oh, I think it's going to be a difficult day. No, it's going to be a real simple day today. Nothing that was critical of him. But no matter what he said, she had something opposite to say. And he noticed it, and he turned to her and he said, you know, it seems that whatever I'm saying, you're saying something oppositional. And she said, no, I'm not. Which is cute, of course, because that was oppositional. And then he also noticed, as he told me, that she wasn't saying anything affectionate towards him. So now we have two factors, the absence of affection and the presence of opposition. Now, if you're ever in that kind of a discussion, my friends, get out of it. What are you doing there? Leave it. It's not going anywhere. You think by accusing your mate and telling them what they're doing, it's going to get any better? No. Seems like there's no place to go at the moment. Maybe give her a foot massage. Maybe do something playful. Maybe get away from the whole thing if possible. But if not, leave the scene. Remember the double bind we talked about last week. The thing that makes the double bind such a difficult situation that leads to pathological results is the fact that you cannot leave. Well, you can. When things are bad, learn how to exit. So, imagine a typical argument. You're frustrated and you're trying to get the upper hand. What are you trying to do in an argument? You're trying to prove you are right and the other person's wrong. Right? That's an argument. Now, what about these arguments? Think about a time when you were talking at each other. Think about an argument that you had with somebody. Can you think of one? In an argument, we are talking at each other, and it's not an argument about an issue, just in an argument. Think about your mind and what your mind is doing when you're in an article, in an argument. Your mind is frantically looking for something to say. So inside your mind, it's like kind of but, and boom, you want to burst out with something and say something. And then if they're arguing with you, they search too and they fire back and you fire at them and then they fire at you. And you're looking for something that will crush the will of the person you're arguing with. You're thinking that at some point, if I present the right words, I will crush their will and they will say, I'm wrong and you're right, which nobody ever does, of course. But you want to crush their will and you want to take away their power. You want to kind of remove their power from them somehow. You can talk about their mother, you can talk about their pathology, you can talk about their history and other relationships. You can try everything you could. You could slice at their knees, you could cut at their wrists, their elbows. Think about how wrong they are while they defend and counterattack with how wrong you are. A classic argument. You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. No, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. You thrust and you parry. Like in a sword fight, the word parry means you defend yourself by holding your sword when someone strikes you, and you thrust when you're attacking with your sword. So you thrust and you parry. Like you're in a, you lunge, right? You lunge and you say things like, you know you're always late. Boom, a lunge. And they parry. I wasn't late today. And you lunge again. But you were late for our wedding. Good lunge. And they parry. But that was because the limo had a flat. Good parry. And you lunge again. But you chose the limo company. And they parry and they counter lunge. Now the counter lunge. Sure, you chose everything else. And you choose that horrible dress you wore on your wedding that made you look so fat. Whew. Really going for the gusto there. Double parry and counter lunge and back and forth and back and forth. What are you doing? What is this about? Of course, this is Armand DeBille with my associates here, and we're going to be talking about a phenomenon in psychology today called hindsight and how that works. But it's frequently used in these arguments. People talk about what happened when and what happened before, and we're going to get to that. Stick with us. Right now, one of the things I'm going to tell you about is I've learned a new technique for arguing, and I want to recommend you. It's very modern. If the idea of a discussion is to fix things, then turn on your computer and go to anything that will record anything. Go to photo booth. If you got an Apple, you go to photo booth. And you go to QuickTime. If you have a PC, go to QuickTime. Go to anything. Go to Skype. Go anywhere where you can make a recording of the two of you in this argument. And just turn on the cameras and talk to each other. Now you will find that the person who is the least interested in resolution will object to the camera. If there's an objection to the camera, then you know there's probably no way out of it. Then you probably know this isn't going to go anywhere. But if there is no objection to the camera, then we're using a very good technique. Now, Dr. Peter Hogan, who is one of my mentors, wrote a few articles on what you could look it up on the internet called the train game. But the main thing that Peter was looking to do was to use videotape replay as a way of helping couples examine themselves during their discussions during conjoined family sessions that they had together. And they would use the video, and he would say, well, what were you feeling at this moment? And he'd replay the video. And so using video replay at the time, which was very cumbersome, this is 30 years ago, they used it as a form of therapy. So did a few other people I know who have done that. But now you can do it because it's accessible to you. Get out your cell phone. You know, do it. Now, you have to be careful because you don't want to do it and then have somebody send it to your mother. You know, you've got to be some kind of respect around it that it gets. But if somebody's likely to send it to your mother, get rid of them anyway. And they shouldn't be around in your life anyway. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. So let's talk about this thing that we're getting to and the reason I bring this to you. There was a time when I worked at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I was working with Sam Berendes and Hirsch Cohen, and they were working on getting the idea of memory and what makes you remember things a certain way. Memory is a kind of a critically important topic nowadays because people are concerned about Alzheimer's, dementia, losing your memory. And what happens as you get older? People are living longer than ever before, and they are also losing memory of many things that have taken place. Words that they can't come up with, like ordinary words, like sled, you know, just like it won't appear as they reach for it. And so people are very concerned trying to understand what's at the basis of memory and why memory changes so. When I worked at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, we kind of proved that memory had a lot to do, or 99% to do, with chemicals, chemical balance, chemicals in your mind. You see, if you could imagine what a neuron is a nerve, right? At the end of the nerve, each nerve, there is this finger-like device called the dendrite. And a dendrite on both sides of a nerve. Now, you got it? So you think about something that's like a rod with fingers at either end, right? That's the neuron, and it's the axon in the middle and the dendrites at the end. The dendrites are little fingers. These little fingers are matching with other little fingers that are around, and nerve transmission takes place from dendrite to dendrite. Now, the way it takes place, this is a little complicated, so I'm going to try to get you to imagine it. Imagine little fingers kind of waving at each other. The electrical impulse doesn't jump over the dendrite to the other one just by itself, and they don't touch each other as one would imagine you would get a transmission to take place. No. What the dendrite does is it secretes a fluid called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine becomes a liquid in which it bathes. Now, the pH of acetylcholine is such that at a certain level and a certain amount of acetylcholine, a nerve transmission can go through the acetylcholine to the other nerve. This happens very, very fast. Now, so where does acetylcholine come from? There's a little thing at the dendrite, at the end of the dendrite, a little fingernail, where there's a protein. And the protein secretes the acetylcholine, which allows for the transmission to take place. Are you picturing this so far? Do you got it in mind, or are you kind of losing it a little? No? All right, so you got this now. So imagine hands reaching out to hands, but they need warm water to get the transmission across. And that's the acetylcholine. Amazingly, the body, after you fire a nerve impulse through the acetylcholine, has another substance called acetylcholine esterase, which comes and sweeps up the neighborhood and gets it ready for fresh acetylcholine. Isn't that amazing? Okay, going back to the acetylcholine. So one of the things we were curious about is, how do you stop memory? And do you stop memory by inhibiting the production of acetylcholine? Well, how do you inhibit the production of acetylcholine? You actually inhibit the protein at the fingernail that secretes it. You can't attack the acetylcholine, so you get the protein. So what inhibits the protein? What inhibits it? What makes it not form? What stops it from synthesizing? And we discovered that there was a substance called acetoxycyclohexamide. Acetoxycyclohexamide, when injected into, and I feel bad about it, but we were learning, Charles River breeding mice, they would forget the tasks that they had learned because they had the protein synthesis inhibited at their dendrites. So we wrote a paper called The Effects of Acetoxycyclohexamide on inhibiting protein synthesis at the nerve ending in dendrites in Charles River breeding rights. That was the name of our paper. It was great. They made a movie out of it. It was fabulous. A musical. Okay. So why is this important? Why this is important is that you should know memory is tenuous. Now, we found acetoxycyclohexamine. Now, acetoxycyclohexamine, you know where you get it from? The equivalent of it would, you'd have to get two cactuses, two nice 10-foot cactuses, and kind of drain them all down. You get enough acetoxycyclohexamine to affect a human. So, obviously, people don't eat cactuses. But we also found that alcohol does the same thing. That alcohol inhibits the protein synthesis at the nerve ending. And therefore, you don't have nerve transmission. And if you don't have nerve transmission, you don't have memory. So the amazing thing about this, my friends, is that alcohol will inhibit memory, which is why people have blackouts. Not all memory, but sometimes enough alcohol and people can't remember what they did. The latest suspicion is that Ambien and Lunesta, the two sleeping pills, that have people waking up in the middle of the night and foraging through their refrigerators or taking long walks where they don't expect it, also inhibits protein. So people don't remember what they're doing. And the suspicion is that with certain neurological diseases and with Alzheimer's and dementia, there is also inhibition of the protein, therefore resulting in loss of memory. So wouldn't it be nice to just be able to say, I am a psychologist, and the reason you don't remember that is because you're blocking the memory, which is what we like to say. But the truth of it is there's probably some chemistry going on that's giving you a hand. Now, all of this leads us on to this subject of this whole idea, this hindsight bias. And here I got to call in my friends to help me out with this. Hindsight bias. Lisa, what'd you find?
Well, we found that there are, memory can be broken down into three main processes. So the first level, which we were calling, I forget what we were calling it. They're calling it, misremembering. So the first level of hindsight bias is
we don't even know what hindsight bias is.
Oh, okay.
What is hindsight bias?
Okay, so hindsight bias is that you remember things in a particular way after something has gone wrong or happened that you didn't want to happen.
Oh, so hindsight bias is, it's like one of these decision traps. And it's been studied by many places because it affects a lot of things. It means that you're susceptible to a phenomenon of remembering things wrongly. Not as they were, but with a bias to how they are. So, for example, a thing could be a guy could be in accounting who's secretly embezzling company funds. Situation may be different every time, but you hear ourselves saying over and over again, I knew it all along. I knew it was going to happen. I should have done something about it. Hindsight bias, right? And now what Lisa's saying is that there are three levels of hindsight bias. One is called misremembering. A second one is called what, Lisa?
The second one is called inevitability. Which is, it had to happen.
And the third?
Is foreseeability, which is, I knew it would happen.
Okay, so the first one is misremembering. Misremembering is a memory distortion which involves an earlier opinion or judgment. It's like you say to yourself, I said it would happen. It's like you just don't remember right. You know the interesting thing about remembering things wrong? Every time you remember something wrong, you really remember it the way you last described it. So let's say you wore red shoes going out of your house, right? And then you say, I wore brown shoes when I left my house. Now, the fact is, what the mind does is it remembers the brown shoes. Even though the red shoes were the original one, you now remember the right one is the brown shoes. So the next time you say, what color shoes did you wear? You say, it was the brown shoes, because you remembered it that way and you repeated it that way. So each time you repeat something that's not true, you create a new misremembrance. The second level is called inevitability. It centers on your belief that an account is inevitable. When you say to yourself, it had to happen. It had to happen. That had to happen. You see a hammer on a ladder, and it falls. And you say to yourself, I knew it all along. It had to happen. Because I remember looking up there and saying, boy, that's kind of tenuous on that ladder. I remember that. And the third level is foreseeability, which involves a belief that we could have foreseen the event, that we knew it could happen. Now, believe it or not, hindsight bias is present in many things, especially in things like remembering tragedies and events like this, and it is very difficult in the courtrooms. In the courtrooms and in certain places, especially with his legal issues involved, you know you're not allowed to bring in a thing that would affect a hindsight bias?
Like prior convictions. So those would influence people's idea of the person and maybe think they were guilty ahead of time before
because,
hearing evidence. Right.
Because they had done it before.
Right, so that would be an example in the legal profession of hindsight bias.
Can also make us overconfident about how we feel about our own judgments. If we go back and we say to ourselves, "I was right," and you convince yourself you were right by remembering wrong what you chose. Let's say you go to a horse race, and you see 5 horses. Or 10 horses, and you pick the yellow one, whose name happens to be Run for Nirvana, right? You just got to, because that's usually how people pick their horses, based on whatever the name is and how it fits in with your moment of your life, right? And so you pick it, and you look at that Run with Nirvana, but you notice, oh, but this horse is like 34 years old. Right, and the others are 2 years old, so I'm going to eliminate that one. Then you look at another one, and the other one says, going for glory. And you go, oh, but that's just like I'm feeling nowadays, going for glory. That's going to be... And you choose them all in your mind, and then discard them all. So when going for glory wins, you say, I knew it. I knew she was going to win. That's hindsight bias. And that makes you convinced that you're a handicapper. And so you go back the next time and you choose and maybe put some money down. And you keep reworking your mind. And practically this is true in almost all gambling compulsions and gambling addictions. You rework your mind to convince yourself that you have an answer, but that you didn't apply your answer properly. If you lose money betting on football games. I knew it. I knew that they weren't going to beat the spread because Tony Randazzo was... Tony Randazzo. Oh. Whoever knows what that name is, you send me an email and I'll send you a present. Tony Randazzo said twisted his ankle, so he didn't show up, so I knew I shouldn't have bet on that team. Right? So the hindsight bias that we use so often, and you hear people using it with each other, you can see it does something to your mind. Now, in an article by Davina Simo, she talks about the need to have a flexible mind because if you are stuck with hindsight bias, you lose the ability to play. And she says that the kind of antidote to getting too stuck in your opinions is to find some way to play to be able to walk naked in the sand, you know, to be able to feel free enough to do it. Because it affects us in such a way. And part of what we do is we use it with each other. We use our hindsight bias to keep ourselves stuck in a place. I think religion mostly promotes hindsight bias in a way. It kind of tells you, you know, this is why you should stay in one place. Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind, here with Lisa Arnone and Jana Valerio. Jana, what do you think?
Well, I was wondering, Armand, is it hindsight bias? Is it almost like you have to justify yourself all the time and why you're right? So you're not open, so it makes you more closed?
Yes, you know, it does help you by rechanging, by remembering things differently than they were, but validating yourself. That's a good word.
Because some people always have, you know, some people really always have to be right. You know, you can't contradict them. You can't, you know, they have to be right. Is it like that?
It's tough when you're in a relationship like that, isn't it? Have you ever been in a relationship like that?
Well, I know people like that, you know, who are generally argumentative and, you know, they have so much invested in, you know, why they need to be right. I don't know why. Maybe they're not so open to other people's
But didn't you ever feel like that yourself? It felt like I had to be right sometimes. Sometimes I'd find myself in an argument and I'd say, I'm just trying to prove I'm right. I'm just presenting all the weapons I have. And I have so many weapons. You know, my tool belt is loaded with stuff. I've got psychological insights. I've got history. I've got this. I got power. I got a... Right? What's in your tool belt that you use in arguments? Well, hindsight bias is one of those tools that we use. And we're not proud of ourselves when we do this. It's not a proud thing, but it's not something you should beat yourself up for also. It's just something that humans do. It's one of the ways that humans found a way of surviving each other. Because I think maybe we were meant really to be alone, but we have to have babies. Remember Battleship Galactica, we're only down to 5,000 humans.
Well, when you were discussing the argument between the two people, we were saying, I was asking you, is hindsight bias? Would this be at the end of the argument about the wedding dress, which ends with the wedding dress? Well, we should never have gotten married. And what is that about? Is it a way to soothe yourself? Is it a way to avoid something difficult? Are you hurt? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because it does take you out of a certain level of vulnerability, doesn't it? It's a power thing. There's nothing worse. I mean, there's a few things worse, but feeling vulnerable, feeling weak, feeling powerless, especially with someone you love. Feeling powerless to get the love that you need from someone who has got the coffer, who is holding the love that you need. Jesus, what a terrible feeling that is. So I guess when you get to feel that bad, and you're going to just do anything to either make yourself feel stronger or maybe get the other person to relent. Using hindsight bias kind of protects you in your own way, knowing, you know, my mother told me I shouldn't have married you. That's the one I'm going to remember. Does it protect you really? No. Does it stop you from growing? Remember what Davina Simo says. Can't get too hindsight biasly stuck because then you will forget to play. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a little special music for Michael. And then we'll be back.
Good. Thank you.
Charlie Parker, the old Savoy recordings. Birds of Paradise. Bird of Paradise, because he was called Charlie Bird. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial. We're talking about memory. We're talking about arguing. We're talking about hindsight bias. It sounds like, you know, you're looking at somebody's bottom when they're walking by. I have a hindsight bias. And I can't see anything but the hindquarters of other people. I know people like that. I know a guy who goes around in a scooter. And he says, you just can't imagine how wonderful it is to see everybody at waist level. He says, you know, you're totally forgiven for that. So anyway, our telephone number here is 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. We do want to take your calls talking about arguments, talking about hindsight bias especially, and talking about memory. Now, memory, I want to go back to memory for a minute. There are different things that will affect your memory, not just chemically, but I think all chemically. You see, there was always this argument, and when I was a kid, the argument was, what causes memory? And it was a real important thing, but now there's no question about it nowadays, now that we understand. So if you interrupt a thing that is necessary for memory, like oxygen, right? People get depleted in oxygen, and they get less and less oxygen, and they have less and less memory. But it's all about this same thing and the protein synthesis and so on and so forth. Now, but there is selective memory. So what does selective memory mean? What does that mean? Things you choose to remember or don't choose to remember.
And I wonder if that's a conscious, I guess it's both conscious and unconscious, because if something's painful, you might not want to remember it.
Well, how can it be conscious if it's painful and it's in your unconscious?
That would be unconscious. I think that if...
Well, let me give you an example. No, yeah. Wait a minute. This is true. I think you're right. When I was a kid, I remember walking across the street and my dog got hit by a car. It was a terrible memory for me. I felt so bad. My best friend, this huge dog, and there was nobody around, and I picked her up and I walked to the hospital with her crying. Terrible. For the longest while, I couldn't hear a car screech without thinking about her and that incident. And I tried to block it out of my mind. And whenever I heard a car screech, I made the selective choice of not remembering. And I remember, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to think about it. And there were people thinking that what I had to do was I went and I was seeing a therapist at the time. He got me to remember it. And not only did he get me to remember it, but we figured out that the reason it was such a traumatic event was not because of the dog itself, but another betrayal that had taken place right before that by one of my family members. And so I was kind of blocking one memory so I would block another memory. Tricky mind. What are the minds like mine? What would you expect but tricks? See? I had to fool myself. So I think there is selective memory and selective, which becomes real. I don't want to think about it. How many times have you heard people say that? I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. There are other things that you forget. You know, like, isn't it always interesting that we forget our dreams? Why? Come on, somebody make sense out of this. Can I do this one with protein synthesis? No, we tested that. We found there was no lack of protein synthesis. So why don't you remember the dreams, except for the fact that maybe the dreams take place in another part of the brain that has nothing to do with your conscious mind, which is kind of what we suspect. Which leads us to another thing called dissociation. In dissociation, what they call dissociation, when a person his so finds different personalities to function at different times in their lives, and they forget between the personalities what's happening. They forget what another personality might be doing. Armand DeMille with you, Lisa Arnone, The Positive Mind, WBAI 212-209-2900. In just a minute, we're going to start our calls. Sensory overload. Sometimes you could have so much stuff going on in your brain you can't remember anything. Anything. Sometimes I wonder about all these commercials that are sent at you and all these posters that you see outside. You don't see them after a while. You forget them. You kind of, they get to be so many that you don't see them. So there are a lot of different things that will affect what our memory is, and some of it is conscious, some of it is not conscious, and some of it is associated to painful emotional stuff. But once more, before we take our calls, which we're going to do, 212-209-2900, a reminder to you all, I want you to experiment. You experiment, the first ones who experiment would give me 20 minutes of an argument, and you could send it to me. You and your husband or wife want to make a video and send it to me of a discussion that the two of you are having, and I will at no cost to you look at it and give you feedback just for the learning experience. So remember, we have these tools available all the time. Take out your cell phone, take out your computer, take out, you know, all the stuff you got. You got QuickTime, Skype. Having an argument on Skype is really interesting because there's a thing called Skype Recorder. It records your calls. And when you listen back on those things, you wonder, you know, what were you doing during that time? So let's take a call, 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Make your calls right now, and we will get to you. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking to you about your idea of yourself and your image of yourself and how a lot of people feel like they're nothing, you know. Lisa, you were going to say.
Well, I'm curious about what you think what's accomplished by not remembering or remembering selectively. And, well, that's part of it. And the other is, how can one do it differently?
Yeah, that's a tough one because to me there's a certain courage you have to have. If you know that you're forgetting selectively, then that means that somehow it's serving you. And you want to find out what's wrong with that. Nothing's wrong with that, except as Davina Simo says, you don't get a chance to play. Well, okay, and it also stops your mind from being very flexible. If you have this bias, then you're kind of always stuck with your kind of predetermination. You're stuck with, I know what's going to happen. I don't want to try because I know I'm going to fail. So there are times that you do want to be able to challenge that.
Okay.
And when you do want to challenge that, when you finally, when you choose to go in there and challenge it, I think you have to be ready. Ready for there to be some side effects of bringing up something that was forgotten for so long. How many of you have forgotten a painful memory and choose to forget it and are so afraid of it? Of course it's going to bring up stuff, tangential stuff related to it. So you got to be brave. I mean, got to be. You don't have to be brave. I mean, be perfectly happy if you're not brave. But if you choose to be courageous in that way, which means to desire not to be afraid of yourself in any way, if that's one of your personal challenges, which you may or may not take on, then I would say you got to go in there and face those memories and let yourself feel them. 212-209-2900. Let's take a call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Armand. I've been listening to your show for over 10 years. Great show.
Thank you so much. Your name? What's your name?
My name is Sean. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hello, Sean.
As a child in school, I was always terrible. Had a great memory, but was never well in school, always failing. Up until about, I was about a sophomore in high school. Then I excelled. Did very well. I have an extraordinary memory. But I must tell you, two things I want to find out. Number one, why didn't my memory work for me the first 10 years of school? And I still, to this day, lose my car.
You lose your car. You no matter, you mean wherever you put your car, you don't remember where it was?
I park it. And where did I park it? I parked it over there. I can't remember where I parked it.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. Except, tell me something. What does your car represent to you?
To me?
Yeah.
You know what? If I had to say, I guess it's almost, my car's almost like a friend.
Uh-huh. And what does your friend do for you?
Most of my friends, not much.
No, what does this friend do for you?
It gets me to where I'm going. It's always there as a, you know, a point for me to be able to do something independently or, you know, an escape or, you know, it's always...
So you have a friend. You have one particular friend who you could depend on, is going to take you wherever you want to go, is going to support you, however, and is going to be there for you and is going to be strong for you. You've got this friend, right?
In my car, I do. But
yes. Now, did you ever have this as a kid? Did you have this when you were 10 years old?
Did I ever have anybody like that, a friend like that?
A friend or a family member?
Yeah.
Who was like that?
My mother.
Your mother. Now, your mother was like somebody you could depend on all the time, and you could always go back to her, and she'd take you wherever you got to go, right?
Absolutely.
So, in fact, you were so close to your mother that you probably weren't as close to your father.
I wasn't.
What'd you say?
I wasn't.
You wasn't. So now you're alienated from your father throughout your early childhood, and you're close to your mother. Are we making sense so far? But during that period of time when you're alienated from your father and you're close to your mother, you're also powerless in school. You're like a guy without a steering wheel when you're in school.
Okay.
All right? Until you start developing sexually.
Ah.
Now something happens to you. Now you're a sophomore in high school. Now suddenly you start feeling all kinds of arousals, testosterone starts flowing, and the little boy who is very close to mom becomes more independent.
True.
And now he's got more of his daddy in him. He's got more maleness in him.
True.
The car represents your safety in a maternal way. That's like having mommy. Every now and then, you want to go around without mommy. And I think what you do is you forget where that is. Because the beauty of it is, besides being lost and being that little child again, without your car, you discover so much more.
Makes sense.
Just a speculation, Sean. So what I would recommend you do, get ready for this. Get on a subway train. Get on a subway train, and for one fare, how much is a fare nowadays? $2.50.
You know what? I don't know.
For $2.50, you could travel all the way from the Bronx all the way down to the bottom of Brooklyn. You can go to Coney Island and beyond for one fare. And you would see adventures along the way. You would look out the windows. You would see people. You would learn so much about life. And just let the train take you there. Now, I say the train because it's a male symbol. Might
Sounds
be
good.
Different than your car. Give it a shot. Let me know what happens.
Sounds great.
Great. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Mom.
212-209-2900. That was Sean. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Me,
yes, this is me, Armand.
Good afternoon. Armand, I was listening while I'm at work. and I'm hearing you talk about memories. And I had a memory from childhood, which I'd suppressed for many years, and it's been coming back to me within the past 2 years. A family member of mine picked me up when I was about 8 or 9 years old. I remember he lifted me off the ground by my clothing, and he beat me with his belt like a horse.
He beat you with what?
His belt. He took his belt off his waist, and he beat me. And I was crying hysterically. My father came home and asked what had happened, and I told him. And my father was so irate, he threw him, he almost broke his door down and told him to take his wife and leave his house. He was an adult man. He probably was in his 20s at the time. But I recently told this to my older brother, who's friends with this cousin who gave me this beating. And my brother got angry at me. He said, holding on to this memory, I'm now in my 60s. He said, because I'm holding this memory for these years, he has a problem with somebody who could hold on, be angry at someone for all these years.
Well, your brother's in a fix because he's friends with the person who beat you. See, he's caught in that position. I can't tell you how many times I've heard this. Yeah. Where they say that. But let me ask you something while we're talking about your brother. Did you ever confront the man?
I never was able to confront him because he left the country and I left the country.
But he's not gone from the country now.
No. He's in my country. I'm in America. He's still in that Caribbean country. And I have not been able to get a hold of him, confront him.
Have you tried?
No, I didn't try.
That's a very good thing, you know. Your brother may be motivated by the wrong thing as to why your brother is angry with you. And his motives are probably mixed. Because, you know, the truth of it is your brother might feel irate. If he really were to believe you and feel justified, he might get angry. Maybe he doesn't know how to confront this kind of anger. Maybe your brother's been abused himself in some way. But the opportunity here is that you somehow can free yourself. And the reason that this memory persists is I think at some point you got to let your feelings be known to that person who did that to you. That you have to free yourself.
You're correct. I've been wanting to, but the way I wanted to do it, I've been talking about it, I said, I want to beat him back the way he beat me when I was a kid.
Okay, that's a good option. I like that. It's hard to pick up a grown man by his skirts.
Yeah.
But no, I understand. I would understand wanting to be violent with him. But if you were to write him a letter, if you were to send him a note, and say, you hurt me and I must get this off my chest, I must speak to you, and would you tell me, what did you... You beat me, and it was a terrible thing that you did with me, and I feel terrible about it. Whatever made you do such a thing? Because he never said you were bad, did he?
Did my cousin say I was bad?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. The thing is, Armand, I was an outside child.
Oh, I see. I understand.
I was living in the household with my stepmother... And my father who brought...
Oh, it's a common occurrence, uh-huh.
Yeah, and so I was stigmatized. I was targeted a lot for a lot of abuse, verbal abuse, physical abuse. They would talk about my mother in my presence. And so anything, they felt like anything would go. The only time I was safe was when my father was home.
And I would say that probably what also happened here is that along with this anger that you have towards him, the reason that you held on to it so long is that some part of you is angry with your father as well. Because I hear the love you have for your father and I hear the protectiveness you have for him, but you know, it should have never happened. It just should have never happened and it should have been cleaned up right then.
Yes, I was angry at him for bringing me into that situation.
That's right, and that's probably where the real anger is holding you back from confronting the other one. Like I said, sometimes we have one issue and we really have another one behind it.
And and this brother as well.
Yeah, as your brother as well.
He's not my mother's child. He's my stepmother and father's child.
What's your first name?
Let me say it's a P.
A P?
P.
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 Good name.
I don't want to say it.
I understand you didn't want to say the country you're from either, because I understand some part of you is afraid that you might be overheard and embarrassed, which also in some way suggests to me that there's it's a much deeper story.
Oh, hey, yes, it is.
Hey, listen, thank you very much for calling in. This is Armand DeMille. I do have
to
go.
Being there.
Oh, sure, anytime. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We'll be back tomorrow at 1 p.m. bringing you more stuff. You can go to WBAI.org, where you could see and download today's program, or you can get archives at thepositivemind.com.